Welcome to the School Sucks Project, a podcast, YouTube channel, and online community dedicated to personal growth and intellectual self-defense.
Today was a good day.
We promote learning alternatives, home education, critical thinking, peaceful parenting, organization and productivity, and better communication strategies. Please remember to visit schoolsucksproject.com to get comprehensive show notes, infographics, relevant links, book suggestions, or just to leave comments. Follow us on Twitter at @SchoolSucksShow. Subscribe to our YouTube channel, username SchoolSucksPodcast, and get involved in our Facebook group. Just search for School Sucks Project.
Mental freedom, in brief. What does mental freedom mean to you? Whether you've had the opportunity to explicitly ponder that question, you've definitely had thoughts and feelings about it. Granted, if we were one of the many billions of people who don't have consistent access to basic sanitation, plumbing, electricity, and other things that the developed world takes for granted, then we'd have more immediate concerns. Despite humans' general absence of political freedom on the planet, our situation in the developed world does indeed provide us the opportunity to ponder what being mentally free means. In essential terms, political freedom and mental freedom both entail having the capacity of choice, the motivation to exercise this capacity, and then choosing as one sees fit, without coercive influences. In the mental realm, freedom entails feeling empowered to operate one's mind and person in an efficacious manner, as one desires, without any debilitating aspects, such as contradictory beliefs, agonizing inner conflict or emotional torment, or an unrelenting, quote, inner critic, or automatic negative thoughts from the subconscious, all of which can express themselves in self-destructive behaviors or self-worth-denying addictions. Distorted thinking about self-concept tends to enter our minds from a very early age, unfortunately, during our attempts to make sense of ourselves in relation to others. Mental freedom also pertains to having the flexibility to shift focus and to attend to whatever we want without being distracted by other motivations, such as obsessing or stressing or being compelled to do something. It means being at peace with our mental processes, rather than being in conflict, at war with ourselves. It means practicing self-empathy and self-compassion. It means having resilience, which includes emotional resilience. This entails being able to process emotions in a natural, authentic, adaptive, self-accepting way, so that they're given the respect necessary to be recognized and to flow through us, instead of remaining unidentified and leading us down more troubled paths. Thus, what mental freedom means is more than just how many choices are in the realm of our material existence. It means really being comfortable with one's sense of self, being at ease and secure within one's own mind and body. As we take into account the past and present input being processed from various subconscious and emotional perspectives within ourselves, as we reflect on the multifaceted nature of the human mind, we can appreciate what an achievement mental freedom is. Psychologist Nathaniel Brandon noted that each of us has a, quote, sage self, a centered and balanced part that's fully present to our experiences and can handle any and all challenges with a sense of realism, empathy, wisdom, and resourcefulness. The sage self is able to sustain us in so many healthy ways, and it gets strengthened as we become more integrated internally. It knows that we are more than our emotional difficulties at any given time, however pressing they may be, as they reverberate strongly through us. The observant part of ourselves, the one that's attuned to our present moment experiences, offers us a path to true enlightenment and enrichment. Of course, it can be sometimes scary to realize just how much we depend on ourselves for our own fulfillment, because it entails fully accepting our self-responsibility, too. True integration also means pursuing and embracing self-knowledge, which entails processing doubt, fear, and pain. Think of when you were a child exploring something fascinating, or experiencing something thrilling or delightful. We can also embody this mindset as a way of life as adults. In fact, it's the birthright of each of us, despite what hurt or sadness we've endured, are enduring, or will endure. Hurt and sadness are inevitable facets of life, of course, but they are by no means the only ones. Life doesn't have to be about suffering or sacrifice, despite what the culture generally promotes, and despite what we might have learned and normalized in childhood. Indeed, we can think differently, or think different, whether or not we're Mac fans. Expectations of obedience and conformity in our culture exact a heavy toll. They become normalized and almost reflexive. Our sense of both inner and outer freedom consequently declines a great deal. Then we're supposed to identify with doubt, fear, and pain instead. So, to keep a stable and secure sense of self tends to entail more mental effort, which can contribute to suffering as well, unless the paradigm is changed.
So we begin session 5. I think we're going to call these sessions. Wes and Matt are still here, and we left a bit of a cliffhanger talking about elephants in rooms. And there are certain concentrations of people within the philosophy of liberty who are trying to address some of those elephants in a larger cultural, societal, political room. But the philosophy of liberty itself, the libertarian movement, for lack of a better word, I hate calling that, has many elephants.
Because it's not really moving, is it?
No. There's many elephants in that room slowing it down. That's something that I wanted to address. Wes and I had a lengthy conversation last night. Part of it dealt with a recent conflict that I mentioned on the show a couple episodes ago in our Facebook group, related to a presentation done by the Gnostic Media podcast suggesting that people who were using nonviolent communication were engaging in a form of neurolinguistic programming or mind control. The thread became very contentious, very ad hominem, lots of people talking past each other. But for me, it was just another example of something we've been witnessing for many years. Failure or a lack of willingness to try and integrate better communication strategies into these efforts to bring more people to the philosophy of liberty. It's not an easy thing to do. We think it, you know, should be easy if people are reasonable and willing to listen, but Wes mentioned a lack of movement, and there certainly has been for some time. So on my show over several episodes, I applauded the efforts of somebody who was at one time a listener and now a valuable contributor to the show, Daryl Becker, who tried to represent a lot of the assets of nonviolent communication. But there's this other problem, aside from nonviolent communication, with I think a lot of people being willing to accept or even recognize or discuss how trauma plays into this bigger picture and how it has produced a lot of the society and culture that we see today. It's kind of been an off-the-table conversation. Wes has dealt with it. Steph has dealt with it. I've, following their lead, dealt with it a little bit on my show. But I see these as two essential attributes of moving forward, and I'm feeling frustrated that there is so much resistance. And I think we were talking last night a little bit about why some of that resistance might exist. And it came up around the question of why are people attracted to the philosophy of liberty? Why are people attracted to, and you know, what else gets a lot of listenership and momentum as far as alternative media is concerned? Conspiracy theory and even discussions of critical thinking or reason, right? We're always so critical, whether we're conspiracy theorists or libertarians or progressives or conservatives, we're always maligning our opponents for their lack of critical thinking abilities. you know? So in those three areas, in those two areas, really, that bring a lot of people to Facebook, that bring a lot of people to YouTube, as far as alternative media is concerned, liberty and conspiracy, I think there's an attraction. And I'm really speaking here primarily from my own experience. I'm not trying to diagnose or pass judgment or make generalizations. People want strength. You know, they want to know what's going on. They want to be in control. They want to, at least in my case, after having a long history of very frustrating schooling experiences where I was made to feel, or I wound up feeling, like I wasn't smart, like I wasn't capable. I described this in an earlier show as a sword I found I could stab people with. And some of the people I could stab were some of the people who had made me feel like maybe I wasn't too bright earlier in life, you know, like older family members. And there, and initially, there was a short-term satisfaction in doing that. And it caused a lot of friction in certain relationships. And, you know, it took me, I think, almost a couple years of doing the show. Wes and I did a series in like 2010 called Escape from Imagination Land, where I was talking about the lack of empathy that I had for other people's blind spots politically when I was recognizing that my own personal life was still so filled with them. So I came to conspiracy first. So it could be, I know something you don't know. And then liberty, the philosophy of liberty was even a more powerful realization, because now I could add moralizing to it, right? Now I could add shaming to it. And boy, was I powerful, you know, with those weapons. And I think there's a lot of people who are in those two pursuits for similar reasons. And, you know, I actually have to credit Steph. It was a conversation that I had with him maybe 4 or 5 years ago, where he asked the very confronting question, why are you here and what are you trying to do? That gave me a lot of pause. I didn't know constructive reasons why I was here, and I had already started doing the show at that point. So if people come here to project strength and control, initially, these are two things, the expression of needs, the acknowledgement of trauma, well, these are weaknesses, right? They're perceived weaknesses. So there will probably be a lot of people who will shy away or run away from these conversations, because we don't need this. This is not what it's about, right? We need reasonable thinking about economics, and we need to shame people using moral arguments. And, well, I think the results are in on where that has gotten us, you know? So this, I guess, is a segue into better integration of these concepts into the philosophy of liberty. That was a long segue, but that's what it was.
Yeah, and the whole moralistic judgment stuff, where is that coming from? It doesn't just come out of the ether.
Right.
You know, we experience this as children. The shaming, the blaming, the good, bad, right, wrong stuff is deeply embedded in our psyche because of the messages that were sent to us in parenting context, in schooling context, in a religious context.
Yeah.
So it's natural. It's familiar. It's very familiar to use that methodology for a way to empower ourselves, which is part of the win-lose scenario of human relationships that has happened for a long, long time, right?
Yeah.
Anytime there's a domination system, then we are talking about win-lose relationships. And it's just so tragic that we look at that process as necessary, you know? The state is necessary. Surrendering your mind to some authority's judgment is necessary. You know,
mm-hmm.
These are the real tragic aspects of the sacrifice meme, and they need to be looked at with scrutiny. But, you know, there's various parts of our minds, and the other part that we haven't talked about is the need for clarity part, the philosophical clarity, the intellectual part of our minds that wants to make sense of concepts.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the folks that are steeped in the refined newer version of the trivium, which is taking from the objectivist metaphysics and epistemology playbook, you know, they find a lot of value in that degree of clarity to understand concepts, to look at things in a logical way, because much of the culture is filled with contradictory stuff, you know?
Yeah.
So ferreting out contradictions is what our mind is designed to do. Otherwise, we're not going to survive.
Yeah.
you know.
And some of them look at it, you know, so intently and so focused that almost every other nuance of human interaction it can be discarded. You know, it's seen as distraction, talking about emotion, talking about the needs or the meta talk of a conversation. It's reframed as manipulation attempts, you know,
and that's mind control. Like, yeah. How do you control another person's mind? It seems to me that all these domination systems are sort of structured to do that.
Yeah.
Whether it's conscious or unconscious, people are involved in patterns of behavior that lead to win-lose relationships rather than really respecting other people and respecting themselves in the process. And there's just so much dishonesty in this process too, in the culture, that it can lead to massive distrust and fear of being vulnerable to various people that can, you know, capitalize on that.
Yeah.
In a very damaging way. So you see this tragic cycle of the initial shame that happens with self-expression in childhood that's shut down or made fun of or whatever it is, exploited. And then there's a sort of a dishonest relationship with that experience as a child, trying to make sense of it from the adult's point of view, like adults know best kind of thing. And so that leads to a disconnection with the authentic part of self, which leads to more shame, because we need to be authentically connected with the deepest part of ourself, the genuine part, the true self, the sage self, whatever you want to call it. And then we tend to engage in inauthentic processes to relate to others, to make nice, to fit in, to go along, which can lead to a whole bunch of defense mechanisms as a result of trying to make sense of this very inauthentic context. Yeah. You know, so the language of Jackal, as Rosenberg articulated, is alive and well in our culture. And it's not really as helpful as what would be the language of a giraffe, as he talks about the speaking from the heart and going into the emotional realm to make sense of things conceptually too. It reminds me of, you know, Brandon's statement, in order to think clearly, we need to feel deeply.
Yeah.
In order to feel deeply, we need to think clearly.
Yeah.
Because without that understanding of the evaluation aspect of our minds, it's hard to make sense of the cognitive aspects of our minds. You know, it's interesting that we have graduate programs in cognitive science, but there's no real graduate programs in evaluative science, you know, yeah, or emotional science.
Yeah.
There's a few inroads into that realm now, as we've been talking about, but I think the whole emotional side of humans really lacks integration on a deep level in our culture. So it's no wonder that a lot of people focus on the intellectual aspects at the expense of the emotions.
Yeah.
You know, the freedom to express how you're feeling and not feel the shame allows you then to deal with the trauma that you're communicating. I'm thinking about the concentric circles too.
Yeah.
You know, that you need to take care of the one in the middle, which is you, and not go out to the farthest circle, which is world economy. But think about that person in the middle, that is you, and how you were not free to express how you really felt as a child, and now how that's manifesting itself as an adult. And I think that a lot of these arguments over things that we really can't or have very little ability to control are just communicating what happened to us as children. And, you know, you ask why we're here. I mean, one of the reasons I am talking with you and Wes, you know, is I've been trying to implement this. And, yeah, you know, there isn't the information that I need as a parent. And so I have to, you know, be creatively come up with it, piece things together based on what I'm hearing from your podcast and other podcasts. And I'm going out now, you know, there aren't many unschooling families really out there. And so we don't have the luxury of many studies that are helping us out. And so I'm going out and communicating how to implement this and how to, the change really occurs, you know, on a childhood level, you know, raising free individuals that are free from the psychological wounds that we talked about, and that can live freely and won't be manipulated by people that are really trying to control our minds. If they control our minds, they control our behavior, and that's, you know, another form of slavery, and that's been a very effective technique for humans. So that's why I'm out kind of talking. I want to learn. I want to talk about my experiences and make a better society for my children to come into. And that is done through, you know, again, breaking the cycle, treating your children. Because, you know, what we're talking about are wounds that happen in childhood that parents could have helped their children avoid.
By looking at their own history, you know, their own traumatic experiences. Right. That's really important for the parent to give compassion to their own child selves so that they can look at their children in a different way.
Yeah. That was a perspective that it took me a long time, I think, to grow into. You know, I really started to have what I would describe as a wake up, like maybe around 2005, 2006. And I wandered around pretty aimlessly for some time.
I'm wondering about, you know, you said mind control and how nonviolent communication. I mean, I get that a little bit where they're kind of judging you as a jackal, or, you know, that could be something that needs to come out and that then you could then talk about. If I'm afraid to communicate something that I'm really feeling, you know, because I don't want to be accused of, you know, jackal communication or something, you know, then that's, you know, I could see how that's, you know, how I'm self-controlling something that, you know, might, that I would like to express. However, you know, it might not be constructive, but it would be constructive in the sense that, hey, this is something that I'm feeling. I realize that it could be, you know, one of these protectors or, you know, something's coming out in my mind. I need it to get out there so I could communicate it, so I could get help for fixing it. Or where is it coming from?
Yeah, and I think, you know, what I've said on the show before about NVC is that it's very important that it's a language you speak to yourself first. And I'm starting to realize with all of this new information and perspective that I've gained in the last couple months, and really intensely, like in the last week, this work of addressing psychological wounds, and, you know, whether it's through IFS, internal family systems therapy, or through some kind of extended mindfulness practice, might have to precede a real, I don't want to say, we can always embrace nonviolent communication, but nonviolent communication might become extra beneficial and extra useful after some of these more internal ideas and practices are embraced and integrated. And then nonviolent communication is a way to better communicate that. I could see it being difficult if somebody, like you're kind of saying, and I think maybe people would have heard that I want to express myself, right? But I can only do that in a jackal way, right? Based on what I'm feeling. Is that correct, Matt?
Yeah, if I'm feeling a little snarky, for example.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, I agree that, you know, it's irrational to communicate nonviolently, but I'm trying to have some empathy for the people that think it's controlling, and I could see how you could say, well, if I'm self-controlling, if I'm not letting some of what I'm feeling come out, is that a form of control?
Yeah, you know,
it reminds me of the NVC trainers that say it's important to connect before you correct.
Yeah,
it's important to empathize before you educate. And when you first start learning, I mean, it's not just nonviolent communication or NVC, it's compassionate connection or connected communication. So it's really connecting with aspects of the psyche that have been kind of forgotten or disowned or dissociated from, in addition to other people's aspects. And that can be triggering in and of itself, because if you've never gotten real empathy from somebody in this culture, it's going to be a bit triggering to get it. And you're going to wonder what that person is up to, right?
Yeah.
You're going to suspect that maybe they don't have the win-win idea in mind.
Yeah.
Maybe there's some ulterior motives. And so that level, that emotion of distrust needs to be looked at and uncover the needs for reassurance, for respect, for understanding, for safety, all those kinds of things. And that plays back into the whole trauma stuff as well. So trauma needs to be part of this compassionate communication process. Otherwise, you know, in the NVC community, you know, I've been to the conference and I've talked with a lot of trainers, and there's really not a discussion about trauma. It's as if people's childhoods didn't really happen. Ingeborg Kostjen actually has some videos about childhood, and she wrote a book about it. And so there are inroads made there, but Rosenberg himself didn't really deal with it in his training seminars and stuff. And I think to some extent, there was some reliving of his traumatic past in his own memorial service. you know, he died just a few months ago. Dominic Barter, one of the NVC trainers there, noted one of the elephants in the room, basically. He realized that Marshall did the world a huge favor by talking about this process of empathy and compassion and understanding needs as the foundation for our lives and the universality of them, and strategies are the things that are in conflict, not the needs, all this stuff. But at the same time, in his personal life, you know, he left his family. I think he had 3 children and a wife, to go teach the nature of empathy to other people, you know?
Yeah.
So he didn't come back to self in that family system to realize that there were needs being sacrificed there. And of course, there needs to be empathy. Whenever we use a strategy to try to meet a need, which is what we use strategies for, we need to have empathy for that, whether or not the need gets met.
Yeah.
You know? So it's a complex thing to understand this compassionate communication process and to relate it to others in a way that that we want them to hear it, you know? So it gets back to like the puppets that Rosenberg uses, the jackal puppet and the giraffe puppet, as like a shorthand for the way people typically react, you know, when you identify what they're, you know, guessing what they're feeling and needing, which is trying to empathize, build a bridge of empathy to authentic communication. A lot of times they suspect that you're up to something else, you know, that's the manipulation aspect, which is, again, part of the traumatic experiences from childhood. When we expressed ourselves in an authentic way, what happened?
Yeah.
How did people react? How did they respond to our expressions, you know?
Yeah, I wanted to go back to something that Matt said about trying to empathize with the people, and you just addressed it too, Wes, the people who would view this as mind control. The first thought that I formed in response to that was a fairly non-empathetic one. Like, well, yeah, if you've never, and this speaks again to the integration of evaluations and understanding of trauma with the effort to communicate this way. If you've never done any looking inside yourself and you feel somebody trying to connect with you in an empathetic way based on what you're really feeling, or making a genuine effort to understand what you're actually trying to say, I could see a sense of threat and a strong impulse to disconnect from anyone trying to do that. I think that that came through all too clearly in these presentations that we're talking about and the subsequent thread that developed on Facebook. For me, and I can only make these evaluations based on things that look very familiar from my own experience. And Matt mentioned the concentric circles of influence that we have. Well, see, in the beginning, like, and this shows up, I think, in a lot of these liberty or conspiracy presentations. My system of concentric circles had like these green tubes that I could go down to warp to another place. You know, that's a Nintendo reference for the younger people. But I could go down a tube from self, and I could warp to the outermost circle, and I could say, see, my life has meaning and I have value because I'm saving the world from tyranny. I'm fighting the government schooling monopoly, and I could warp back and high five myself to the innermost circle, you know. And I think that's a temptation. There's a kind of illusion of control there, an illusion of efficacy or usefulness or meaningfulness that allowed me for a substantial portion of time to ignore a lot of things about myself.
I think there's a usefulness to that. It's important not to dishonor or discount that warping process, because you are trying to heal the world through new ideas. That's an important thing, but it doesn't need to be an either-or process.
Right, exactly.
I hear you saying that when people indulge in the abstract or the political philosophy, it can be at the expense of the inner healing process.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, so it can be a both and that we can engage in.
But that's the point. I mean, that they're connected. And what I'm hearing is a lack of trust that, you know, was probably formed in childhood. You know, was it your parents that would kind of manipulate your emotions in order to get something from you? Was it a priest? Was it a politician that had lied to people? I mean, one of the psychological wounds is problems with trust. And how would that manifest itself? Well, it might manifest itself in coming out when someone's empathizing with me, I am trying to really hear what I'm saying. That brings up fear in me, because in my childhood, the only people that did that misused that trust or misused that information against me, maybe.
Yeah, it shows
that's spot on.
Yeah. again, there's an integration between these wounds and our ability to reason effectively. You know, I immediately start thinking of logical fallacies that come to mind that are probably employed because of, you know, some kind of emotional root. You know, I don't trust anything the government does. Well, that's incomplete. You know, that's an incomplete explanation of your relationship to the government and your understanding of trust, right? But it's easy for us to use logic or misuse logic when a lot of our thinking has these emotional entanglements that haven't been identified. I mean, if I had a list of fallacies in front of me, if the three of us had a list of fallacies in front of us, we could probably look at, you know, more than half of them and see, either from our own experience or from things we witnessed firsthand, how an emotional kind of confusion led to the use of a certain fallacy.
Or even an emotional energy.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I'm feeling pissed off, so I really need to engage in this way with these people.
Mm-hmm.
To get a point across, even though I'm overlooking some evidence, perhaps, or
yeah.
I'm creating a straw man to make it seem like I really won.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But the psychological wounds are manifesting themselves in irrational behavior, illogical behavior, using illogical fallacies in our arguments. And sometimes that's how our brain is communicating some of the trauma that happened to us. As children. And this is why it's so important to stay in the concentric circle, the point in the middle of the concentric circle, and fix that, and then go to the next circle after that. But
yeah.
this is what we're talking about, right? What does it take to avoid these psychological wounds? How do we need to parent ourselves? What do we need to do this to get to, you know, all the beautiful benefits of having these psychological wounds behind us, or at least dealt with, you know, like healthier, sleeping better, you know, not feeling guilty, not feeling depressed, you know, being happy, being able to be calm and centered. You know, this is all the things that we're trying to get to be able to listen to someone empathetically, to be able to help someone. You know, that's where we want to get to. You know, what I'm hearing in some of these conflicts is that people aren't there, and you know, your body won't let you progress if you haven't dealt with some of these psychological wounds that you have. It's too scary to move on through this world if, you know, with a cylinder missing, so to speak.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think, as you mentioned, Matt, keeping this meta talk as part of the conversation, you know, the way things are being said, the trigger points, you know, what are you feeling as a result of this discussion? Addressing this and creating a safe and compassionate space for yourself and for others to be able to talk about the flavor of the conversation, you know, and what's alive in each person. I think that safety and that compassion is something that we can do, again, to reparent ourselves and reparent our culture to create a more mindful process by which to heal and grow from this.
Absolutely. And I think this would be a good transition into talking about the requisites for this kind of recovery through, I believe, some of Pete Gerlach's work. Some of the things that he mentions, we addressed this with other language already, but I think we should go through this and make it explicit. Awareness, knowledge, motivation, being in a pro-recovery environment, doing a kind of therapy like inner family or internal family systems therapy as well. So I thought we could go through each one again individually, starting with awareness, Wes.
Yeah, practice of living consciously,
yeah.
Right? That's mm-hmm. the first pillar of self-esteem, as Brandon has articulated in the six pillars. And I think related to that, obviously, is the seventh pillar, although that directly relates to the motivation facet of number three. But awareness is part of this process of waking up. You know, I remember Brandon saying that most people tend to be sleepwalkers through their existence. And when we're just going with the flow and advocating status quo systems, we haven't really woken up yet to the possibilities of change and growth.
Mm-hmm.
But once we become aware of these ideas, then another choice confronts us. Do we want to go down this path? What does it mean to see the code of the matrix and how to deal with that in a way that is self-nurturing and nurturing for others rather than this combative process, as you mentioned, Brett, that can be used as a way to, you know, kind of get back with the motto, paybacks are a bitch kind of thing. You know, so having that awareness. And it's interesting that, you know, the Buddhist folks, I've gone up to Dartmouth a few times and heard various Buddhists talk about mindfulness and stuff, but there's really no mention of a lot of these things we've talked about. So even the proponents of mindfulness have facets of their awareness that are not turned on yet, or maybe are actively avoiding awareness of some things, because these elephants in the room are pretty much always there.
Yeah.
They're in conversations, they're in discussions of any kind of political thing, obviously, or any schooling thing, any religious thing, like all this stuff is here. This philosophy matrix is with us all the time. So just having the awareness of that can be troubling, uncomfortable, disconcerting, because it has implications for our needs for connection with others and acceptance, you know, and reassurance. So
could I pipe in here, Wes?
Sure, absolutely.
You know, I mean, I think this is why we're talking about the ACE studies. I think they're missing from, you know, Buddhism and even from nonviolent communication. You mentioned that they don't mention that. And this is a huge, huge elephant in the room. This is a huge thing that people are missing. And I think back to that rheumatoid arthritis study in Bessel van der Kolk's book.
The Power of Self-Compassion, IFS and the Treatment of Rheumatoid Arthritis. Nancy Shattuck is a rheumatologist at Boston's Brigham and Women's Hospital, who combines medical research on rheumatoid arthritis, known as RA, with a strong interest in her patients' personal experience of their illness. When she discovered IFS at a workshop with Richard Schwartz, she decided to incorporate the therapy into a study of psychosocial intervention with RA patients. RA is an autoimmune disease that causes inflammatory disorders throughout the body, causing chronic pain and disability. Medication can delay its progress and relieve some of the pain, but there is no cure, and living with RA can lead to depression, anxiety, isolation, and overall impaired quality of life. I followed this study with particular interest because of the link I'd observed between trauma and autoimmune disease. Working with senior IFS therapist Nancy Sowell, Dr. Shattuck created a 9-month randomized study in which one group of RA patients would receive both group and individual instruction in IFS, while a control group received regular mailings and phone calls regarding disease symptoms and management. Both groups continued with their regular medications, and they were assessed periodically by rheumatologists who were not informed which group they belonged to. The goal of the IFS group was to teach patients how to accept and understand their inevitable fear, hopelessness, and anger, and to treat those feelings as members of their own internal family. They would learn the inner dialogue skills that would enable them to recognize their pain, identify the accompanying thoughts and emotions, and then approach these internal states with interest and compassion. A basic problem emerged early. Like so many trauma survivors, the RA patients were alexithymic. As Nancy Sowell later told me, they never complained about their pain or disability unless they were totally overwhelmed. Asked how they were feeling, they almost always replied, "I'm fine." Their stoic parts clearly helped them cope, but these managers also kept them in a state of denial. Some shut out their bodily sensations and emotions to the extent that they could not collaborate effectively with their doctors. To get things moving, the leaders introduced the IFS parts dramatically, rearranging furniture and props to represent managers, exiles, and firefighters. Over the course of several weeks, group members began to talk about the managers who told them to grin and bear it because no one wanted to hear about their pain anyway. Then, as they asked the stoic parts to step back, they started to acknowledge the angry part that wanted to yell and wreak havoc, the part that wanted to stay in bed all the time, and the exile who felt worthless because she wasn't allowed to talk. It emerged that, as children, nearly all of them were supposed to be seen and not heard. Safety meant keeping their needs under wraps. Individual IFS therapy helped patients apply the language of parts to daily issues. For example, one woman felt trapped by conflicts at her job, where a manager part insisted the only way out was to overwork until her RA flared up. With a therapist's help, she realized that she could care for her needs without making herself sick. The two groups, IFS and controls, were evaluated 3 times during the 9-month study period and then again 1 year later. At the end of 9 months, the IFS group showed measurable improvements in self-assessed joint pain, physical function, self-compassion, and overall pain relative to the education group. They also showed significant improvements in depression and self-efficacy. The IFS group's gains in pain perception and depressive symptoms were sustained 1 year later, although objective medical tests could no longer detect measurable improvements in pain or function. In other words, what had changed most was the patient's ability to live with their disease. In their conclusions, Shattuck and Soule emphasized IFS's focus on self-compassion as a key factor. This was not the first study to show that psychological interventions can help RA patients. Cognitive behavioral therapies and mindfulness based on practices have also been shown to have a positive impact on pain, joint inflammation, physical disability, and depression. However, none of these studies has asked a crucial question. Are increased psychological safety and comfort reflected in a better functioning immune system?
And one of the things that emerged that these people with this terrible autoimmune disease that probably could have been avoided is that all of these people as children were supposed to be seen and not heard. So this reminds me of what happens in the ACE studies where, you know, people are communicating their trauma in tragic ways. And I think this is part of the awareness of the psychological wounds that could happen from a traumatic childhood that needs to be dealt with before you can move on. It will manifest itself in terrible health problems if you have a very bad or very high ACE score, but even in things that your parents did that may not have been ACE worthy, but still not productive. For example, that I experienced with kind of a lack of emotional connection, you know, and how that manifests itself later on and the psychological wounds that brings up. So I think that's part of the awareness, and a requisite for recovery is really this ACE study acknowledging what is really happening that I think many of the philosophies are missing.
Yeah. And from there, awareness can build into knowledge through things like Breaking Free. That was a series that Wes did on Complete Liberty about the Nathaniel Brandon book by the same name. Wes and I also did a show about it a couple years ago. Obviously, other elements of Brandon's work, the art of self-discovery, I am still working through. A journaling practice can expand awareness. A mindfulness or meditation practice can expand awareness. And obviously, a willingness and motivation to expand awareness leads to knowledge. And one of the really amazing things for me, really just in the last couple weeks, is my knowledge on the topic or the exploration of the emotional landscape never expanded so quickly in such powerful ways. And I said this in the last show about the body keeps the score. And again, applying science, specifically neuroscience, to these challenges that earlier in life were always so confusing and so much easier to try and distance myself from or run away from or ignore entirely or have not so beneficial strategies of trying to escape. And, you know, it would be left with something that some people might scream out loud or something that we quietly ask ourselves, like, what's wrong with me? You know, and not treating it as a neurological, biological problem that can be addressed. You know, a brain that was changed through certain experiences. It's a crude comparison, but I'm going to make it anyway. I've experienced very little emotional distress. Backstory, Wes and I and Carlos went out and played basketball. About 6 weeks ago, I wasn't thrilled with
my. We tried.
I wasn't thrilled with my performance, right? But I lose very little sleep over the fact that I can't dunk, right? Like, I've kind of accepted the fact that my 37-year-old body only grew to 5'10", and there are physical obstacles, right? It's not distressing for me that I'm unable to do that. But when we go into the emotional realm and away from the physical realm, some of those same changes that came from genetics or biology or environment are incredibly stressful and incredibly disconcerting. You know, I would recommend, as far as the body keeps the score is concerned, to take it slow. I consumed half of the book yesterday, and that was a lot, you know?
A lot to digest there.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, a chapter a day, like we could have, I'm thinking the three of us could have done this entire series in one day, but I wanted to give people a chance to digest each part, and I recommend the same thing for something like that. I found myself getting really, really emotional reading this book, not just because of some of the stories are pretty heart-wrenching, but also the clarity that came so quickly from especially chapter 17 that I've been including in the shows, but the earlier chapters of the book as well. Being able to think logically about the emotions is incredibly beneficial. And the clarity that came, and I'm not saying that it will always stay right where it is through challenging situations in the future, but it gave me a lot of optimism about dealing with that future. You know, to have this knowledge. I mean, we're talking about requisites for recovery. This is number two, knowledge. Very, very few situations in life are made worse by adding knowledge, and this is certainly an example of that. So that was my experience with the second requisite for recovery. You guys feel free to add what you like.
Self-knowledge, yeah. That's kind of the key to all this, isn't it? Integrating the information from awareness into something that's comprehensible.
Uh-huh.
And yeah. As Matt says, you know, we acquire self-knowledge because we always communicate trauma. And until we get enough self-knowledge as a culture, as a system of families and tribes, if you will, communities and so forth, until we have enough knowledge that kind of tips the balance so that we don't communicate trauma anymore, so that we have enriching experiences by and large, then we're going to really need to focus on this stuff in order to have an enriching life, in order to have new possibilities for a future that entails a lot more needs fulfillment than needs sacrifice.
Yeah. And it's not just knowledge. Knowledge is key, and that should provide, hopefully, the motivation, which is the next one. And
yeah, nice segue.
Yeah, and the motivation is either hitting bottom, or you know, hopefully coming to it from a knowledge base. But I thought what Brett said in one of the earlier sessions, where he was, behaving in the ways where the benefits of recovery. Trying to be more serene, have less stress in his life, you know. So Brett was jumping, in effect, to the outcomes of these requisites for recovery. So that isn't sticky, right? So in order for it to be sticky, you can't just change someone's mind, right? You want to change the wiring to them, and that's largely what happened in childhood. So. You know, it's a difficult thing to do, and it requires a lot of motivation. You know, Molly and I, we speak to a counselor, you know, every other week, every third week. You know, it's $100 every 3 weeks seems like a pretty good investment, and we're able to, you know, sit with each other and kind of know that we're going to be talking about these things that have come up that we just can't get through together. You know, I have an IFS book by is it Jay Early? Self-therapy, that was helpful. But I it was, when I first got it, it was very confusing. But watching Gerlach's videos, Wes, that you gave, that was helpful in moving through IFS and what to do when we have the knowledge, what to do when we have the motivation, you know, how to take the steps to get through these wounds that we have. It's a long procedure, but what we're trying to communicate is through the ACE studies and such, you know, where these things come from, and this knowledge is very important in order to work through it.
You know, there's a great line in The Body Keeps the Score, and I might be paraphrasing it a little, but I think he says, and this speaks to knowledge and motivation, you can't do what you want until you know what you're doing. you know? And that is like so simple and so powerful. And it goes back to something I said earlier, and I certainly said it in, you know, our series on the Trivium method of critical thinking. You're so much more ready to move through a kind of assembly project when you've labeled the parts you're trying to put together, you know? And it's a similar idea here that I think a lot of people, and I talked about this in the past with addiction, a lot of people go through life not really ever happy, but not really ever unhappy enough to do anything about it, you know? And even though I think people like that want to be happy, it's like, where the fuck would I start? You know, what would I do? I've heard all these things, you know, I've heard about meditation, I've heard about medication, I've heard about therapy. How do they work together? What's the ratio of one to the other? And there's just a lack of clarity about making a personal map. And we also, you know, live in a society where cure-alls, panaceas are promoted. One-size-fits-all solutions are promoted. People get discouraged because they don't hear, they hear somebody else raving about results and then they don't get those results. So we see why, if the first two requisites are not addressed seriously, this third one of motivation just kind of falls flat, right? Because I think people want to jump in to do something, but they don't know what to do. And I mean, I say they, like I couldn't add me to this countless times in my life, wanting change, but not knowing how to get it, you know? And I think that if I'm honest, it was about a lack of completeness and persistence through the first two, awareness and knowledge and self-knowledge.
Yeah, but don't you think a lot of these are hidden from us? I mean, purposefully?
Absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I'm not a big conspiracist, but, you know, why didn't I know about this? You know, why wasn't this sung from the rooftops? This, you know, what did it take till my mid-30s or 40s to find out about the A score and start to put the pieces together myself? You know, that's where I got the motivation. And then, yeah, what do you do afterward? Put yourself in a pro-recovery environment. I would say that's what we're doing here in New Hampshire.
Yeah.
You know, we were fortunate enough to have a nice place that's pretty rural where we could just concentrate on our family. You know, I don't go on Facebook. Yeah. You know, I don't think that's a real pro-recovery environment. I think that, you know, when the people that I talk to, I like to have great conversations with Wes and you, Brett. This is helpful for me. Molly and I talk constantly. We talk with our children constantly. And, you know, we have therapists once in a while that help us out. That's been very useful for me.
Yeah.
Emotional tune-ups. Yeah. We all need to take that time in and have that emotional empathy for what's going on. You know, in the seventh pillar, Brett, you know, we did the series on the six pillars. The seventh pillar is the motivation to practice all those six pillars. You know, so even if people focus on that alone, like doing those sentence completion exercises on each of those pillars, that goes a long way to checking in with self and having an empathetic connection to all of these various parts, many of which can be either, you know, managers or protectors of the traumatized parts.
Yeah.
And finding more integration in that process. So I guess as far as motivation, you know, having an awareness of your emotions and the strategies by which you're trying to deal with those emotions is really key to finding that motivation to make changes in the direction of healing and growth. But I think a lot of people don't have a clear vision of what's on the other side of the change, you know?
Yeah.
And so, because we're not really given examples of that. Hardly anyone grew up with examples of people who have practiced the six pillars of self-esteem, like deeply, genuinely, and applied it to their lives and all of these elephants in the room, you know? So there can be lots of dissociation from these uncomfortable aspects. And that can lead to more disconnection and lack of integration and the motivation to actually change.
I think that's a really good point, Wes. You know, we're talking about the awareness of the ACE studies and the problems with trauma in childhood. But what I think what you're saying is, you know, a motivation could come from the benefits, you know, the benefits and how, after you've gone through this, what you're trying to get to. And we haven't had models of happy parents. We haven't had models of non-stressed people around us. And I think that's what you're saying. And that's what we try to do, Molly and I, with our kids. We have fun. You know, how many kids grew up in a household where there wasn't any fun?
And where they're constantly doing things that they don't want to do.
Exactly. And how does that affect your motivation? It's hard to visualize what is on the other side, right? When you've never seen a model of it. And I think that might be a good use of our time. And I think we'll hopefully get to that. You know, what are the benefits of this recovery period?
Yeah. And they're lifelong too, you know, to have that connection with self and others that is win-win, I think is one of the keys to understanding all this, rather than this prevalent meme in our culture of sacrifice, self-sacrifice, or sacrificing others for self. You know, this is set up with all the domination systems. And, you know, trying to distance oneself from those systems can be very difficult because they're pretty much all around us. You know, you turn on the television, you go to Facebook, you do any of these things, you're going to come up against all of these contradictions and just reliving of unprocessed trauma. So to bring awareness to others can be an uncomfortable process as well, because you're going to get all kinds of emotional responses that need processing as well, you know, and need empathy. So yeah, it's a challenge on an epic scale, but when you focus on your own self and your own connections with others that are enriching, that's, I think, where the real change happens. And then the more people that do that, the more the culture tends to change.
And there's just so few people that, you know, we have to communicate out. And the more people that we could get to see these things that we've been fortunate enough to see, the better it's going to be for everyone around us. It's not a quick fix. You do have to put yourself in a pro recovery environment. I think it's well put here. And really think about what you need to do to heal this. And like we said, this, the body keeps the score, very pro IFS approach. Again, internal family systems, we're all composed of these sub-personalities. A lot of them are somewhat destructive, but they're there for a reason. And then having friends around and having people around that you trust and friends that will actually confront you about important things is a very great friend to have.
Yeah.
And it's a difficult thing to do. And to, you know, not have these people around you that are shaming you, blaming you for things, getting in the right environment where you can breathe and focus on and commit to healing yourself and going for what we all see as great things: better health, less confusion, thinking more clearly. And like we talked about before, you can't just jump to that.
Right.
You know, critical thinking is great, but in order to critically think, you've got to heal your wounds. In order to be, you know, in order to be calm and meditate, you've got to heal your wounds. You have to go through, these wounds are there whether you're meditating or critically thinking, and they're going to bias you. You need to look at them, you need to deal with them, and then move on. And it helps, you know, dealing with these tragic things that happened to you as a child, dealing with those, then you could critically think a lot easier. Then you can meditate and be calmer. Then you can nonviolently communicate. But you can't skip over these things that we're bringing up.
And you can certainly experience initial successes with those things along the way in that journey. You know, like we're all, as Daniel Mackler said, I've never met anyone who was done. You know,
yeah.
So we're always going to be on this journey. So just so no one is picturing a destination, all of these benefits of recovery are able to be realized along the way. You know, I meditate now. I think critically a lot of the time. You know, I feel really over the last couple months a great sense of relaxation, satisfaction, accomplishment. All these things are there to be realized along the way. And I think that one of the things that we've mentioned a couple of times that's really helpful in acknowledging the benefits is being in that pro-recovery environment, which is, you know, surrounded by people who are on a similar path, or at least motivated to be on a similar path, who are communicating openly and are talking about challenges, but also sharing successes. And, you know, I've talked about some of the pro-recovery environments that I thought I was in the past, and, you know, we've spoken about one critically, and I'm happy to say that I'm finding others, but for too long, you know, this is so important for me because for too long, I believed I could survive without one. And my life is not the ideal pro-recovery environment. Life as a whole never is. But finding safe spots within that, I think, is really important. Groups of people, support settings, that matters a lot. And I've really been trying to orient my thinking around putting myself in those situations as much as possible.
Makes sense.
Yeah.
And don't you think that if, you know, some of the things that you talked about, if you're not getting those in your life, that's important information that you could use to then go back and say, okay, what have I not healed?
Yeah, sure.
And so it's kind of a feedback loop. Okay, I'm feeling impulsive, or I'm not sleeping well. I have this guilty feeling, you know, why, and really kind of go into it, hopefully with someone that you could talk with about these kind of ruts that you get into in your life. And, you know, this is a whole feedback loop, and it is going to continue your whole life. And it is difficult, but the other side is quite a beautiful thing.
Excellent.
So that might be a wrap, guys.
We're never done.
No, we're never done. We aren't.
Ongoing series. Continuing mission.
I like that, Matt. We're never done. We could always add. The word addendum is beautiful because you can just continue to add on forever if need be.
Indeed. Well, thanks for sharing all this, guys. And it's been a really enriching conversation.
Did that seem like 10 minutes to you? I mean, it seemed like no time.
Time warp. Yeah.
Well, we started about 3 hours ago today. How about that?
Well, I'm up to do it again. I still have a few questions that I'd like to talk about, including how to teach history to a 12-year-old.
Oh, yeah. We could go beyond this and do all kinds of things. Yeah, that would be terrific.
Or how does a 12-year-old teach history to herself?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. I definitely want to say thank you both. And like I said in the show, obviously, this was a conversation or a series of conversations that required a lot. And I really appreciate your openness, you know, in front of thousands of people.
Millions, perhaps.
Perhaps one day, yes. I know it takes a lot to do that, and I have already, you know, had feedback coming in from the two episodes that I put out so far that people are getting a lot of benefit from this, and wouldn't have been possible without the two of you. So thanks.
Yeah, I appreciate it, Brett.
You're welcome.
I'm looking forward to being good friends.
Yeah.
Confronting each other on our things. Now that we know this, we can actually put it into use.
Mm-hmm.
So I look forward to more of this and getting the word out. I've gotten some emails back too.
That's great.
Yeah, no, it's helping people, and it's that makes me feel good.
Take us home, Wes.
Maybe we can go noodling for some catfish too.
There you go.
Or bass or trout. I haven't fished the rivers or lakes here in New Hampshire, but I guess there's some pretty good eating fish out there.
Oh yeah, especially if you like mercury.
Yeah.
That might only be certain
and like
ones.
Matt likes it raw and wiggling.
Yeah, and wiggling.
It's been a nice journey, and thanks for having me on, Brett. I appreciate the in-depth, authentic conversation about things that really matter, things from the heart. And I hope everyone just continues the journey with themselves and with the people that they really care about and who care about them.
Yeah, thanks much.
That's the end. Perfect. Perfect. We got it. We did it. Okay, everyone, that is the conclusion of this series for now. If you can think of ways for us to expand, I would be happy to invite Wes and Matt back to keep on exploring. And Wes said something there right at the end about continuing on this journey, and I think that's a really important thing to think about for me. When I listen back to this, at the very beginning of the conversation, I could have been a little more cautious with my language, and to some it might have sounded like I was doing this collective diagnosis of the Liberty Movement. And first of all, I don't like that idea at all of the Liberty Movement. I'm a much bigger fan of Ben Stone's personal liberty mission. That's how I like to think about it. That's what I like to think we do on this show. And of course, I do not see myself as someone at the end of that road looking back, but somebody somewhere in the middle of that road looking in both directions and reporting to you what I see and experience. And I'm saying this right now because this is the first thing that I've recorded since I got back from the Porcupine Freedom Festival just a couple of days ago. Now, if you've never been to that event, it's great fun. I've had some of the most fantastic experiences of my life there. I've made some amazing connections there. I've learned a lot of things there. And I will also say that it is kind of a difficult place for a man like me to live consciously. My attendance there was kind of the culmination of several very challenging and in some ways stressful months. In fact, if I wasn't asked to participate in the event in several ways, I probably would not have attended this year. In fact, I even went home in the middle of the week for a little respite from exposure to the festivities. So I am happy to report on the other end that I didn't do anything regretful, for me anyway, regarding, you know, drugs or alcohol. But I could, in that environment, feel myself slipping a little bit. You know, like I definitely experienced a test of my willpower, and you only get so much, you know. So while I'm trying not to do certain things, you know, there's other temptations like, hey, do you want a cigarette? Hey, do you want ice cream? Hey, do you want to make out with me? And you only have so much willpower to spend each day in a place like that. But for me, it was a test, and I left there feeling very accomplished. And there were certainly some other challenges there for me that I'm not going to get into on the show, but if I had not been so immersed in this work for the last several months and really intensely for the last 6 weeks or so, I don't know, honestly, if the outcome would have been as positive for me. And, you know, it got me thinking about the power of knowledge. I remember, like, the first time I was on Complete Liberty with Wes back in 2008. I forget whether I was talking about, like, the government or the mainstream media or the schools, but I said, you know, they are always trying to get us to organize what's in our minds in an emotional way, because if they can get us to do that, we can't think about what we're being told in a rational way. And is that really true? Does it really have to be one or the other? I think through this exploration, and especially the lens of internal family systems therapy and neuroscience, I've learned quite a bit about how to think critically about the emotions, even while I'm having them or watching somebody else have theirs, and being able to identify what's happening, even if I'm not 100% sure psychology is a soft science. It's provided me a lot of clarity in situations that, you know, even a few months ago would have been terribly confusing. And I think this effort to better understand and manage our own internal emotional terrain and better empathize with the emotional terrain of others comes down to the same three steps, essentially, that we have been talking about on this show in one form or another since the summer of 2013. And I will label them like this. Number one, we acknowledge and identify. You know, whether we're talking about the getting things done method of productivity or the trivium, nonviolent communication, or really even the six pillars of self-esteem fits into this as well. After that, we go on to step two, which is accept and integrate. So we acknowledge what's going on in ourselves. As we get better maps of our own emotions, we are more present and available for others. and reasonable with ourselves. And then that final step, intention and action. Mutually beneficial, voluntary, peaceful communication. Purposeful steps towards solving the problem or meeting some kind of goal. So yeah, I faced some challenges and I feel pretty good. And this exploration and the knowledge that I've gained is a huge part of that. So the most sincere of thanks to Wes, who led me down this path, and Matt, who was there for support, and many, many others as well. We are going to finish today with the end of Chapter 17, From the Body Keeps the Score by Bessel van der Kolk. And that clip at the very beginning of the show was from Chapter 1 of Wes's new book, Complete Liberty Inside Out. Check the show notes for more information about that. Thanks for listening, everybody, and take care.
Liberating the Exiled Child. Peter ran an oncology service at a prestigious academic medical center that was consistently rated as one of the best in the country. As he sat in my office in perfect physical shape because of his regular squash practice, his confidence had crossed the line into arrogance. This man certainly did not seem to suffer from PTSD. He told me he just wanted to know how he could help his wife to be less touchy. She had threatened to leave him unless he did something about what she termed his callous behavior. Peter assured me that her perception was warped, because he obviously had no problem being empathetic with sick people. He loved to talk about his work, proud of the fact that residents and fellows competed fiercely to be on his service, and also of scuttlebutt he'd heard about his staff being terrified of him. He described himself as brutally honest, a real scientist, someone who just looked at the facts and, with a meaningful glance in my direction, did not suffer fools gladly. He had high standards, but no higher than he had for himself, and he assured me that he didn't need anybody's love, just their respect. Peter also told me that his psychiatry rotation in med school had convinced him that psychiatrists still practiced witchcraft, and his one stint in couples therapy had further confirmed that opinion. He expressed contempt for people who blamed their parents or society for their problems. Even though he had had his own share of misery as a child, he was determined never to think of himself as a victim. While Peter's toughness and his love for precision appealed to me, I couldn't help but wonder if we would discover something I'd seen all too often. That internal managers who are obsessed with power are usually created as a bulwark against feeling helpless. When I asked him about his family, Peter told me that his father ran a manufacturing business. He was a Holocaust survivor who could be brutal and exacting, but he also had a tender and sentimental side that had kept Peter connected with him and that had inspired Peter to become a physician. As he told me about his mother, he realized for the first time that she had substituted rigorous housekeeping for genuine care. But Peter denied that this bothered him. He went to school and got straight A's. He had vowed to build a life free of rejection and humiliation, but ironically, he lived with death and rejection every day. Death on the oncology ward, and the constant struggle to get his research funded and published. Peter's wife joined us for the next meeting. She described how he criticized her incessantly, her taste in clothes, her child-rearing practices, her reading habits, her intelligence, her friends. He was rarely at home and never emotionally available. Because he had so many important obligations and because he was so explosive, his family always tiptoed around him. She was determined to leave him and start a new life unless he made some radical changes. At that point, for the first time, I saw Peter become obviously distressed. He assured me and his wife that he wanted to work things out. At our next session, I asked him to let his body relax, close his eyes, focus his attention inside, and ask that critical part, the one his wife had identified, what it was afraid would happen if he stopped his ruthless judging. After about 30 seconds, he said, he felt stupid talking to himself. He didn't want to try some new age gimmick. He'd come to me looking for empirically verified therapy. I assured him that, like him, I was at the forefront of empirically based therapies, and that this was one of them. He was silent for perhaps a minute before he whispered, "I would get hurt." I urged him to ask the critic what that meant. Still with his eyes closed, Peter replied, "If you criticize others, they don't dare to hurt you. Then, if you are perfect, nobody can criticize you." I asked him to thank his critic for protecting him against hurt and humiliation. And as he became silent again, I could see his shoulders relax and his breathing become slower and deeper. He next told me that he was aware that his pomposity was affecting his relationships with his colleagues and students. He felt lonely and despised during staff meetings and uncomfortable at hospital parties. When I asked him if he wanted to change the way that angry part threatened people, he replied that he did. I then asked him where it was located in his body, and he found it in the middle of his chest. Keeping his focus inside, I asked him how he felt toward it. He said it made him scared. Next, I asked him to stay focused on it and see how he felt toward it now. He said he was curious to know more about it. I asked him how old it was. He said about 7. I asked him to have his critic show him what he protected. After a lengthy silence, still with his eyes closed, he told me that he was witnessing a scene from his childhood. His father was beating a little boy, him, and he was standing to one side thinking how stupid that kid was to provoke his dad. When I asked him how he felt about the boy who was getting hurt, he told me that he despised him. He was a weakling and a whiner. After showing even the least bit of defiance to his dad's high-handed ways, he inevitably capitulated and whimpered that he would be a good little boy. He had no guts, no fire in his belly. I asked the critic if he would be willing to step aside so we could see what was going on with that boy. In response, the critic appeared in full force and called him names like wimp and sissy. I asked Peter again if the critic would be willing to step aside and give the boy a chance to speak. He shut down completely and left the session saying that he was unlikely ever to set foot in my office again. But the following week he was back. As she had threatened, his wife had gone to a lawyer and filed for divorce. He was devastated and no longer looked anything like the perfectly put-together doctor whom I'd come to know and, in many ways, dread. Faced with the loss of his family, he became unhinged and felt comforted by the idea that if things got too bad, he could take his life in his own hands. We went inside again and identified the part that was terrified of abandonment. Once he was in mindful self-state, I urged him to ask that terrified boy to show him the burdens he was carrying. Again, his first reaction was disgust at the boy's weakness. But after I asked him to get that part to step back, he saw an image of himself as a young boy in his parents' house, alone in his room, screaming in terror. Peter watched this scene for several minutes, weeping silently through most of it. I asked him if the boy had told him everything he wanted him to know. No, there were other scenes, like running to embrace his father at the door and getting slapped for having disobeyed his mother. From time to time, he would interrupt the process by explaining why his parents couldn't have done any better than they had, there being Holocaust survivors and all that implied. Again, I suggested he find the protective parts that were interrupting the witnessing of the boy's pain and request that they move temporarily to another room. And each time he was able to return to his grief. I asked Peter to tell the boy that he now understood how bad the experience had been. He sat in a long, sad silence. Then I asked him to show the boy that he cared about him. After some coaxing, he put his arms around the boy. I was surprised that this seemingly harsh and callous man knew exactly how to take care of him. Then, after some time, I urged Peter to go back into the scene and take the boy away with him. Peter imagined himself confronting his dad as a grown man, telling him, "If you ever mess with that boy again, I'll come and kill you." He then, in his imagination, took the child to a beautiful campground he knew, where the boy could play and frolic with ponies while he watched over him. Our work was not done. After his wife rescinded her threat of divorce, some of his old habits returned, and we had to revisit that isolated boy from time to time to make sure that Peter's wounded parts were taken care of, especially when he felt hurt by something that had happened at home or on the job. This is the stage IFS calls unburdening, and it corresponds to nursing those exiled parts back to health. With each new unburdening, Peter's once scathing inner critic relaxed, as little by little it became more like a mentor than a judge, and he began to repair his relationships with his family and colleagues. He also stopped suffering from tension headaches. One day he told me that he'd spent his adulthood trying to let go of his past, and he remarked how ironic it was that he had to get closer to it in order to let it go.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed the show, please help us out by leaving a positive review on iTunes. If you were angered by the show, please help us out by leaving negative reviews everywhere. If you think this is an important message for students, for parents, or for the future of intellectual freedom, please consider supporting us. SchoolSucksProject.com/AV. For $6 a month, you'll get access to hundreds of additional hours of content while helping us grow and spread this message further.